to Little Atoms. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, skepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. These ideas find their antithesis in superstition, religious fundamentalism, fanaticism, medievalism, totalitarianism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I'm Padraig Reedy, and I will hand over to Neil Denny to introduce this evening's guest.
Thanks, Padraig. Our guest tonight is Bruce Hood. Bruce Hood is currently the director of the Bristol Cognitive Development Centre in the Experimental Psychology Department at the University of Bristol. He has been a research fellow at Cambridge University and University College London, a visiting scientist at MIT, and a faculty professor at Harvard. Bruce is here to talk about his book, Supersense, From Superstition to Religion, The Brain Science of Beliefs. Bruce, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So let's talk about what is Supersense, what do you mean by Supersense, and I suppose when did you first decide to research this field and why?
Okay, so the title Supersense is really a marketing idea. It came from the publishers. I originally wanted to call it the Supernatural Sense, and that was really a homage to a colleague of mine, Steven Pinker, who wrote a book called The Language Instinct. And I kind of was trying to make the same parallel with language, that we're born with mechanisms in our minds which allow us to interpret information in the world in a certain way. So it's almost as if it's something to do with the wiring of our brain. So I tried to get that title, the Supernatural Sense, to the publisher, and they said, no, we need something a little bit more snappy. So that's why we came up with Supersense. And I got into the area, I suppose, really almost upon reflection in many ways, because I'd been working in the field of developmental psychology for about 20 years. And I thought, well, look, I've reached a point in my career where I need to write something down, you know, produce a volume of work. And I was inclined towards spreading, you know, my knowledge, if you like, to the general public. So I thought, well, what can I write a book about? And there are lots of books about developmental psychology or parenting books. And then I thought, well, that's not really what I really want to talk about. And I went back to, I looked over all the sort of stuff I'd been doing, and I realized that actually there were some common themes running through this work, namely that throughout development, throughout childhood, we're interpreting the world in terms of all the evidence that's out there, and we're trying to figure out, and we're coming up with explanations about the world. And sometimes we come up with weird and wacky ideas. And I realized that, you know, a lot of the childhood notions about the way the world works could be seen to be the basis of what are adult supernatural beliefs. And I made this kind of leap of logic, as it were, put these two things together, and then began researching the book and realized that actually there's a kind of coherent story here.
So by supernatural beliefs, things we often talk about on this show, religion obviously is the main one, but things that are non-religious, like, you know, extrasensory perception and sort of supernatural beliefs like that. And as I said, those are things that we often cover. And you talk, there's a chapter which, actually I'm really surprised that Channel 4 have not snapped this up for a game show title yet, but there's a chapter called Could You Wear a Killer's Cardigan, which explores some things that we might call secular superstition. Yeah. So let's talk about that. What sort of things are we talking about there? First of all, tell us about the killer's cardigan.
Well, the killer's cardigan was that's actually a stunt that actually got the whole thing going, to be honest. I was giving a public lecture for the British Association for the Advancement of Science, and I wanted to make a dramatic point about how our behavior and our beliefs can be automatically triggered, almost in the absence of any kind of rational thinking. So I thought through all the literature, what would be a good example? And I pinched an idea from a researcher called Paul Rosen, who he did it with a Nazi helmet, I think, originally the first time he did it. But basically, people will show a great reluctance to come into physical proximity or contact with something which has been worn by somebody evil. And he made an argument that this is almost sympathetic magical thinking. So I thought, well, okay, how can I turn that into something for an audience? So I came up with Fred West, which was a little bit more familiar to a British audience. And actually, it was during a press release for journalists, so it worked really well. So the stunt was basically I pulled up this old cardigan in a box, and I said, how many people here would be willing to wear this cardigan? And the press, you know, the journalists kind of a bit being used by the question. Then I said, well, I'll give you £10. Of course, you know, they want their beer money. So the hands went up. And then I said, okay, would you still wear it if you knew this was the jumper of Fred West? And then we had this menacing image of Fred West rising on the PowerPoint display. And most of the hands went down immediately. And of course, it's an automatic reaction. And it's only afterwards that you start to rationalize why you did it. In other words, you make a decision. You behave before you've even had a chance to kind of figure out what it is that's being asked here. And I was trying to get this idea that a lot of our beliefs and a lot of our behaviors seem to be driven by unconscious processes. And some of those unconscious processes, when you look at the reasoning behind them or the rational thinking behind them, don't add up. In other words, there are some aspects of unconscious thinking which could be considered irrational. Now, I happen to think the Cardigan response is not irrational, and we could sit here for another hour describing why it's not irrational. But the point is that people are making that decision in the absence of any conscious appraisal.
Well, let's sit here for, rather than an hour, let's sit here for 2 minutes describing why it's not rational. Because I'll be honest, I'm with all my skeptical rationalist credentials, would have said no, I wouldn't. I would have found it deeply, troubling. So how do you see it as a not irrational impulse to have that reaction?
Well, just going back to the original anecdote, there were, of course, some people who kept their hands up, but the people around them moved away from them, or they looked at them in horror. So you can see this as a mechanism which identifies you as someone willing to behave differently from the rest of the group. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you can have responses or belief systems which work as a coherence, that identify you as a member of a group who share a common assumption or a common belief. So even though it's irrational in the sense there's no kind of physical contamination that can go on, from the group's perspective, this is a moral question. This is almost like something which transgresses the behavior of the group. And so anyone who's willing to do that is almost identifying themselves as someone who's willing to kind of step outside what is considered normal behavior by the rest of the group. So in that sense, it is a rational behavior to kind of say, I don't want to wear it because I don't want to be seen to be outside the common consensus. But the basis in terms of the potential for any contamination, of course, is not rational.
Yeah, of course.
It's interesting that the example that you gave from the first experiment, which was a Nazi helmet.
Mm.
I wouldn't want to put on a Nazi helmet, not because I necessarily associate that particular item as being sort of somehow contaminated by something, but because I wouldn't want to be associated with the belief system. So, for instance, you talk about the idea of touching, physical contact with people that have sort of transgressed. And I would have a problem with, for instance, shaking hands with a Nazi or something, or shaking hands if I was confronted with an extremist politician. Nick Griffin or George Galloway or Ian Paisley or somebody, I wouldn't want to shake hands with them because I wouldn't want to be thinking that I was sort of accepting them in some way. Like saying, hello, I accept you, come to my house, stay at my house, eat my food, sort of thing,
Well, Neil, you've raised an interesting point. Why do we shake hands? Why do politicians have to have this physical contact? Why do we need to touch the idols in our world? The royal touch, there was a point in time in British history where people who had scrofula, which was a skin disorder, would go and be touched by the king or someone of royalty, because the assumption was they had magical power by contact. In many ways, this need to have a physical contact or repulsion at the notion of physical contact is getting at this idea I develop in the book, which is called essentialism. This is the idea that individuals have some essence of identity which permeates through their body and can almost permeate and contaminate the objects which they've come into close proximity. So yes, you're perfectly right by saying that by willing to wear a Nazi helmet or shake the hands, you're identifying yourself as someone willing to do that. But then that just restates the question, why is physical contact such a marker for this? And that's the point of the book in many ways.
You go on later in the book to talk about our sort of instincts of disgust and repulsion at things, and it may be smells and things and chemicals. So let's at this point perhaps talk about where some of those things come from. Why do we feel a sort of physical repulsion at certain things? And these things could be cultural. Why do we feel repulsed at the idea that somebody else somewhere in the world might eat a dog or a horse or something?
Well, anyone who's got a child younger than 2 years of age will know that they don't have much of a context of or a concept of disgust. They do all sorts of gross things. But certainly from around about two to in the preschool years, they start to learn and culture starts to shape what they find disgusting. So there are some hardwired aspects of disgust. There are certain chemical smells that we know will trigger a response, and these presumably have a biological origin for that.
And this is like decomposing bodies.
Decomposing bodies is the strong one, which it's automatic. You can't stop yourself doing it. There's an anecdote in the book when I talk about the instance when I stood in the belly of a bloated carcass of a dead cat, and I've never forgotten that, and I'm now very phobic.
Such a lovely image, we're not going to forget it either.
So I thought it was a very descriptive bit of writing, but anyway, yeah, so there are certain smells and certainly sensory stimuli which are hardwired in. You don't have to learn mm-hmm. them. But what does happen with foods, for example, in taste preferences, they do become enculturated, and even attitudes towards certain behaviors, they seem to piggyback and trigger the same kind of emotional systems, the disgust systems in the brain. So when people say they're physically revolted by a sex act, for mm-hmm. example, then actually it's triggering the same systems which would be revolted by certain smells and that. So this is how it hijacks the biology. Culture hijacks the biology to produce and shape behavior.
Okay, well, let's move on. Before we get to the second half of the show, I want to look at an idea. You talk at quite some detail about why people believe in creationism as an idea. And again, it's something we've talked about a lot on the show, but what I think is really interesting that you bring to it is this idea that the very idea of learning and studying evolution as a theory is somehow counterintuitive to us. So, well, I'll let you take this up. Why do people find it easier to believe in creationism than they do to believe in evolution?
Well, Richard Dawkins has written about this a number of times. It's as almost as if we're designed not to understand natural selection, because, first of all, we don't have the luxury of time to see these things occurring.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk at it theoretically, but the notion of seeing something evolve is very difficult because we have short lifespans.
Of course, we weren't around to see God create the earth either.
That's
in
true.
7 days.
Well, there's another mechanism, of course, which is testimony, and of course we are inclined to believe what people tell us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the book I really try to balance these two things. I think the arguments, just to give a bit of context, with a neo-atheist movement, is to argue that everything is down to indoctrination, that children just believe everything they're told. Mm-hmm. Well, they certainly have an inclination to believe adults, but then, of course, they're filtering information all the time. And you then have to ask the question, well, why do two children raised in the same household have totally different belief systems? So I think there's another side to the equation, namely that not only do we tend to believe what we're told, but we vary in our ways that we interpret information. And I think that's what I mean by the supersense. Some of mm-hmm. us are more inclined to woo, as I've heard it described, this notion that there is extra dimensions, there is stuff going out there, it can be explained. So getting back to the original point about why is natural selection so difficult, we don't live that long to see it happening. But I think the real problem is this idea that we have a common ancestry, the idea that we all share, all life forms have a common heritage. Now that just smacks me in the face of common sense, because I don't think I have any resemblance to a banana, but I share 50% of my genes with a banana. Now you try and tell me that in a kind of detached logical way, and I can understand it in a logical way, but it just doesn't resonate with me. And that's because we are naturally inclined to see different species as being fundamentally different from each other. And this is what we call essentialism, this idea that there's an internal, invisible property of living things which make them very different. So the notion of a common common ancestor and common evolution is actually very counterintuitive. And that's the reason that creationism is just so easy to absorb. I should point out, by the way, the developmental studies have been done with children. And in fact, children are expressing creationist ideas, even if they're raised in atheist households. It's only when they get to later childhood that the influence of the home and the environment starts to shape them either towards a religious bent or towards a creationist one. So my point is, again, it's almost the default is to go for a creationist type of point of view.
Mm. You're listening to Little Atoms with me, Padraig Reedy, and Neil Denny, and we're talking to author of Supersense, Bruce Hood. Bruce, we've just been talking about the way that developmentally, very early on, people can go in two ways, and also how two people raised in what could be pretty much identical circumstances can come to very different conclusions.
Mm.
And this feeds into something we were talking about earlier about how interpretation is a massive part of any human experience.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of criticism of, say, what we broadly call the skeptical community of being quite black and white.
Mm.
Do you think that it does neglect to take into account the factors of interpretation that we can work in our everyday lives?
Yeah, I mean, this is a point that's really troubled me, looking at the neo-atheist movement and skepticism. I think Dan Dennett described it as the supers versus the brights in his book Breaking the Spell. But the trouble is that people rarely, on any dimension of personality or any way you want to measure humans, they rarely fall into two discrete categories. There's a lot of gray area in between. And the reason I focused on secular supernatural notions rather than talking about religion was I wanted to draw people people's attention to the fact there's a whole gamut of strange, weird, and wonderful beliefs that people have. And I know many atheists who entertain the possibility of the paranormal. Atheists aren't necessarily anti-supernatural. They're just anti-religion. And that's a different issue in many ways. And so I think by focusing on all these other aspects, you know, killer's cardigans, or the fact that 9 out of 10 people think they can tell when they're being watched from behind, you know, that's a secular supernatural notion. It's equally as daft as the great spaghetti monster in the sky, and yet people hold these sort of notions. So I think that by focusing and looking for almost the non-religious examples of that, I'm hoping to show that there's a wide distribution of belief systems. In many ways, I don't think we can get away from it. I think it's just part of the wiring of the brain is to kind of interpret the world all the time. And yes, we do listen to what people tell us. We are inclined towards testimony. But the number one reason people believe in the supernatural is that they've had some personal experience that they can't explain away. So testimony is important. But when you ask people, why do you believe in this? They say, well, you know, I had this experience and, you know, I just can't make any sense of it. And science doesn't seem to be able to explain it for me. And that's why they're inclined towards these things. But of course, the way that you interpret an experience is defined to some extent by what you think is possible in the first place. So weird, wonderful nonsense happens all the time. Weird coincidences happen all over the place. If anything, they're not unusual. They're very usual. It's the interpretation you put on those incidences which defines whether you become a kind of believer or not.
But is it an essentially human thing to try to fill in the gaps?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, because the thing is, you know, the way that we know, and getting right down to all levels in the nervous system, okay, the world is complex, it's ambiguous, it's noisy, the signals are really distorted. You have a biological computer in your head. This is what the brain is. It generates the mind. And it's trying to make sense of this, interpret the world. It's trying to build models about the world. It's trying to anticipate things. It's trying to make predictions. This is what we do par excellence. And in doing so, we have to fill in missing information because it's either absent, it's occluded, it's obscured. But we build these models, and quite often we come up with models or conclusions where actually they're not actually true. But because the process is constructive and you're making, you know, sense of missing information, then it's all too easy to interpret that bump in the night as being somebody there, or there's a face in the pizza slice, or, you know, all manner of phenomenon are easily interpreted as being some evidence of a deity or supernatural power.
Bruce, there's a point in the book, and I really wish a lot more writers do this, but where you bring us to a halt and say, I'm paraphrasing, but pay attention to this next sentence, because basically it's the nub of what this book is about. It's the argument of the book. And this sentence reads that children generate knowledge through their own intuitive reasoning about the world around them, which leads them to both natural and supernatural beliefs. Okay, so children are taking on knowledge, and some of this may be supernatural beliefs. Okay, so I'd like to talk about why and what's the use? What's the point? Why? And presumably we're talking back in, you know, back in the times when we were all running around naked on the savannah or something. Mm-hmm. But what would have been the use of supernatural beliefs to a human being?
Well, before we get to the supernatural beliefs, can I just take you back to intuitive reasoning? Because most people will be unfamiliar with that as a notion. And it almost sounds an oxymoron to have intuitive reasoning.
Sure.
What we mean by that is that these are untutored, untaught processes that, for example, a lot of my work is with babies under 12 months of age. They don't understand what they're, you know, you can tell them E equals MC squared, they won't really pick it up. So they don't actually have language. But what they will do is they will look around the world and they will notice patterns that you talked about earlier on. They'll notice that there are reoccurrences. There are certain things which seem to follow regularities. This allows them to interpret the world of physical objects. They know, for example, that objects shouldn't levitate. They know that objects can't pass through each other. They also start to think about things as being special kinds of objects, objects that move by themselves. Well, they're a different category. They might be alive. So they're starting to build models of kind of the physical world, the biological world, and even starting to infer the presence of mind. So this is what I mean by intuitive reasoning. And this is before education. So presumably, way back when we were pre-hominids, we were also figuring out the structures of the world. No one was telling us. There was no communication. There was no language. Along comes along language, where people can share experiences, expectations, and you can start to pass on information. And it's true. There are two systems of learning and reasoning about the world. There's one which is intuitive, which is almost unconscious in many ways, and a more rational analytical system is what we call education, where people come along with facts and we combine this. Now, sometimes the two things run counter to each other. For example, Newtonian principles of motion. Mm-hmm. People think that heavy objects fall faster. That's their intuition. In fact, it doesn't. You can teach them Newton's third laws of motion and say, actually, they fall at the same point. But the point is, you never abandon the intuitive notion, and the college students typically fail these sorts of things. So
I absolutely could fall for that myself. So just go into a bit more detail with this one. Explain what you're talking about there.
Okay.
The experiment.
The experiment would be, for example, you imagine two cannonballs, but one weighs 100 times the weight of the other.
Yeah.
You drop them from the Tower of Pisa. What happens? Most people recognize this as Galileo's original description. Most people say, well, the big cannon, heavier cannonball falls much, much faster.
Because that's obvious.
It's obvious. But in fact, they fall at the same point. And I never believed that until I saw a physics teacher demonstrate that with a feather and a penny in a vacuum tube. It does. They fall at the same rate. And Newton proved that to be the case. But the point is that intuition never goes away. Mm-hmm. Now, what I'm saying and why I'm raising this as an example is you can teach someone information, but at an intuitive level, they can hold a completely different worldview. Now, the thing is that when you've given this new knowledge of Newton's third law, they never abandon the original idea.
Absolutely.
It lies there. In fact, we can demonstrate that experimentally if you get them to answer quickly or you give them a second kind of thought experiment, which kind of occupies their rational analytical brain, they'll start answering intuitively again. So the mind is composed of multiple mechanisms. Some of them are unconscious. Some of them are kind of analytical, propositional discussion type of things. And they're competing. They're competing all the time. Now, to get to the example, why would the supernatural ever come in?
Be useful.
Well, because many of those supernatural assumptions just seem intuitively correct.
Mm-hmm.
They just seem more plausible. The notion of there being life after death seems plausible because people can't easily conceive of non-existence. The notion that you can tell when you're being watched from behind, most people have had some experience of that, and we feel that we're being stared at, so we think that that must be some sort of energy transfer. Or that there is an evil cardigan. You know, it just seems intuitive that there's, you know, that evil is something which can contaminate, and that's why we don't want to be close to somebody, and so if it can contaminate, maybe it can go into their clothing and so forth. So these are all manifestations of belief systems which emerge naturally as children. Children think about essences that I mentioned earlier on. They assume that dogs are different from cats because they have some doggy essence inside them. Okay, they can't articulate that. There is something, Simon, it's called DNA, but no four-year-old can tell you about DNA. But they know from a very intuitive sense that there must be something invisible inside the dog which makes it different to the cat. So it's actually not very difficult to then take that notion of essence and then make that almost like a contaminant, like I was talking about with evil. So what I'm saying is that the supernatural is only supernatural because it violates the natural laws as we currently understand them, but they could emerge quite easily and spontaneously in every normal child.
Okay, to finish off then, you've mentioned a couple of times the neo-atheist movement, and you mentioned Richard Dawkins, Dan Dennett, and people like that. Without wanting to put words in his mouth, I'd say that it was, you know, one of Richard Dawkins' beliefs that supernatural thinking and non-rational thinking is something that can be gotten rid of at some point in the, you know, in the human future, and that would be a good thing. The world would be a better place if we somehow managed to eradicate totally irrational thinking. It's not going to happen, is it?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's going to happen because if my argument is correct, which are these are basically coming from the same reasoning mechanisms, that you're always going to be generating supernatural beliefs. That's one issue. Second, I think they do have a functional role in that people need to have a sense of belief.
Mm-hmm.
We're not entirely all our decisions are not all based on evidence. You know, we would make a lot of assumptions about the world, so this is filling in the missing gaps. So beliefs are actually fairly common, and I think that Richard Dawkins, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that, you know, we should just bend over or lay down and allow religion to dominate and control policies and science decisions. I'm not saying that in the slightest. I'm saying recognize the nature of your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Once you recognize the nature of your enemy, you'll be able to deal with it a little bit better. But you're always going to have a problem. With every child born, they're going to be born with the same brain, which will start to generate the same kind of belief systems again. I mean, the perfect experiment would be a kind of, you know, Lord of the Flies type of thing. Let's see what happens when you raise children by themselves without any of these influences. And my bet would be that they would come up spontaneously with the monsters in the cave and, mm-hmm. and the gods, and they would just do that naturally. So giving people rational education is a great thing because, you know, we need more skepticism in this world because there's a lot of nonsense being perpetrated. But we have to recognize that it's kind of inevitable that this will always be there. It's just curtailing its influence is the main problem.
Well, presumably that experiment itself has been run on like a planet-wide level, and the civilizations that have grown in isolation from each other have all come up with those same ideas.
Yes, but of course we've always had hierarchies of individuals who try to exert influence by testimony and saying and claiming some moral ground. So these are always going to be issues. But I think that simply gets back to the point that, well, how can they easily rise to this position? Well, because people think that there maybe are special people out there who have powers, who have some, you know, direct connection with the divine. So it's a again this inclination. We need leaders and we need the sense of the supernatural, hence the super sense.
And that's a good point for us to end on. You've been listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and we've been talking to, me and Padraig Reedy have been talking to Bruce Hood about his book Super Sense, From Superstition to Religion, The Brain Science of Belief. Thank you very much for joining us, Bruce.
You're very welcome.